The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hello, this is The Takeaway for Thursday, November 10th, 2016. Keep the conversation going on Facebook. We're at The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks for listening. I like that word, listening. That's our mission this week, listening. After all of the surprises, listening perhaps makes the most sense. Listening, for instance, to a voice of an American whose idea of America is not something you would normally hear in a public radio pledge drive, say.
Now, if you're going to go down the road of 100% racial purity, that's ridiculous. No country has that. But a country needs to have at least a high percentage, like 80 or historically in the United States, 90% a white Christian heritage. And that's what our country was. And that's what's changing.
Or listening, as we will this hour, to a mom trying to explain to her kids that it's still okay to be Muslim in America.
Her little face crumpled up. And I was like, "Are you sad?" And she said, "Yeah, Mama." And she cried, and she cried, and she crawled into my lap. And so we talked about the fact that even if he's president, there's a lot of laws and regulations. We talked about the fact that there's a Senate and a Congress.
Or listening to a Democratic congresswoman who heard the discontentment in the northern industrial states, but nobody heeded her warnings.
I go to the bars. I'm in those union halls. That is what I do every weekend. People say I do too much. I don't do too much. I want to know what people are thinking. And if you're listening to people, you know what was in their heart.
We will hear more from all three of those people later this hour. You'll be fascinated by their identities. It's not exactly his style, but if there is someone who could credibly say, "I told you so," in response to the Trump victory this week, he would never do that. But it would be New Yorker writer George Packer.
There is a sort of rigging of the game against people who don't have access, who don't have the right connections, and who don't know how to play the system.
George Packer was saying that back in 2013. Packer was talking about his award-winning book, The Unwinding. It's the story of the deindustrialized void in rural America and the faces and people who had lost faith in institutions. And as he told us today, we're looking for a political home. Well, George Packer says, they found one on Tuesday.
I was in Western North Carolina. I was in Youngstown, Ohio, Tampa Bay, all places that were hotly contested and that became part of Trump's victory. And what I saw was a sense of utter disconnection from power, from the people making decisions, whether in Washington or in New York, in the media, in business, technology, and especially government, and a resentment, a sense of, "You've forgotten about us. We don't count anymore. Our way of life doesn't seem to matter. We used to be the heartland. Now we have, you know, opioids and people on disability, and we're sinking, and people are blaming us for it." So there was a lot of an undercurrent of anger and resentment and even despair that found its voice in Trump. And so to me, his emergence was not a surprise. His victory was, but that's another story.
As you traveled the country and spoke with people who felt forgotten, what did you think the political opportunity was for either party? And what did you think was the natural political home of these people should their collective anger find expression in an election? And again, you know, while we're talking some years ago.
Well, this was during the recession. And race had something to do with this for sure. I mean, there was a reaction against our first black president that animated some of the people I wrote about, not all of them. And there was an economic factor. And there was just a kind of collapse of, I don't know, to sound a bit 19th century about it, a collapse of standards, as if, you know, well, if the elites are going to misbehave, then why should we try to do any better? And let's all sink to the lowest level of our trash pop culture. That was a strong feeling I had, and Trump is a creature of that. There was no natural political home, John. That's what I came away feeling, was that the Republicans were too pro-business. Because there was a lot of anger at corporations leaving the country and at tax breaks and free trade. And and also at immigrants being used to take jobs that may or may not have been once taken by these people. The Democrats were too collectivist and too pro-government. So neither party really had an answer. And this year we've seen in succession the establishment of each party repudiated. First, Trump represented a rebuke to the Republican establishment, a middle finger to it. Sanders represented something slightly less vitriolic to the Democrats. And now Trump's victory is a kind of FU to both party establishments. And I think we can't underestimate the pure sort of nihilistic, I just want to smash things message that was sent on election day. I don't think it had a particularly well-formed ideology. I think it was a gesture and a lashing out.
How much time do you think the new president has to deliver some, you know, message back to Trump land that, you know, help is on the way?
If it's a matter of, you know, getting us out of trade deals and suddenly miraculously steel jobs, coal jobs, manufacturing all come back to Western Pennsylvania, West Virginia, northeastern Ohio, I don't think that's going to happen. And I think there's going to be a severe disillusionment. But Trump is a master at the rhetorical side of politics, and he sort of represents a direct line of connection without any intermediaries to his supporters. And as long as he can speak for them and to them in a way that is satisfying and resonant for them, they will continue to support him. I think it could take a while for facts to sink in, because a lot of facts didn't sink in during this election campaign. We seem to be in a new era where facts are trivial matters compared to feelings, gestures, and rhetoric.
Is there a rewinding of some of these communities in some coherent way? Okay, we're not going to snap our fingers, cancel the trade deal, and the factories are going to come back. But is there some way to coherently, intelligently, slowly reverse what's been unwound?
Two things. First, part of what I meant by the unwinding was the collapse of institutions, not just of communities, but of institutions, including our own, John, including the press, as a healthy, viable force in a democracy. Those institutions look weaker than ever today. And so that is a really long, difficult process. And it requires a public engagement and a public belief, like an end to this distrust and cynicism. How does that happen? Well, maybe there has to be some generational change. Maybe it takes 30 years. As for the communities that I was in, you know, the economy has improved in all of them, but marginally. And after years and years of decline, people don't believe it or it's not enough. If that continues, then sure, there can be economic comebacks, and with it, some kind of re-knitting of the social fabric and some kind of a revival. But the trust in institutions and in leaders is the real nub of the matter. And Trump swept all that aside by saying, don't trust any of them. You can't trust the media. You can't trust the election system. Trust me. And that puts a lot on his shoulders. Maybe feeling it a bit these days now that he's actually caught the truck. But on the other hand, it also gives him tremendous power, because there's something, you know, he's the direct expression of this political tendency now. There's no political party in between him and it. So he has the populist demagogue's authority right now, and he could do a lot with it.
What would you change about our electoral system based on the result this week?
Well, a lot of people I'm talking to wish there were no such thing as the Electoral College, which is an odd, antiquated thing out of the Constitution that doesn't seem to serve any purpose except to every now and then, every 20 years, deny the majority its will in a presidential election. I don't think the electoral system needs to be changed except for money. And money was not the issue this year.
No.
It was not the Koch brothers' years. It was not the super PAC's years. Jeb Bush, you know, had what, $100 million in the super PAC that couldn't begin to lift him up. The problem isn't so much the campaign finance system right now, although that's a perennial problem. The urgent problem is the utter distrust of so many Americans for the normal functionings of democracy, for the normal functionings of the press, for the normal functionings of elections, which we were told were going to be rigged, and for the, you know, the normal functionings of Congress, which now look, you know, after years and years, look like it's meant to achieve nothing, to simply kill everything that comes along. So there's a lot of corrosion in these democratic institutions. That's what I keep coming back to, and that's what the unwinding is really about, even though it's the story of individuals in America.
Is the trust restorable?
Well, it has to be. I mean, that's a statement of faith, not of I don't have a practical plan. I try to avoid punditry as much as possible, although I don't always succeed. It has to be, because that's what this country is about. And that I'm really torn today, John, because on the one hand, I hate what happened on Election Day, and I dread what's to come. I had a very hard time talking to my children the next morning and telling them that, you know, everything will be okay. I couldn't actually tell them that. But on the other hand, you know, half the country has spoken. John Dos Passos once wrote, "All right, we are two nations," in his great USA trilogy. And I feel that. We are two nations. That bothers me as much as anything. How do we become one nation again? Do we give the other side a chance when they didn't give Barack Obama a chance? Is that a sucker's game? I'm really torn, because I want there to be a revival of faith in democracy, but I don't see how it can happen when it's a street fight in a pitched battle and seems to keep spiraling downward.
George Packer is a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of The Unwinding, an Inner History of the New America. George, always great to talk to you.
You too, John. Thanks.
Congresswoman Debbie Dingell from the 12th District of Michigan, what the heck happened in the industrial northern states?
Well, unfortunately, I was one of the people that predicted that it could happen. If you were out there, you were listening to people. I spent a lot of time in union halls. Part of my district has a lot of auto plants where jobs have disappeared. People are still nervous, anxious from the 2008 economic crisis, are not sure that their jobs are secure. Donald Trump tapped into that, understood, heard what they were saying. And in the end, we didn't do a good enough job of understanding how deep their fear was and what was really going on in the ground.
Boy, did Congresswoman Debbie Dingell have a lot to say when we spoke with her. In the state of Michigan, Donald Trump squeezed out a victory with just over 13,000 votes, according to a final unofficial vote count. Prior to Tuesday, a final polls plus forecast from 538, though, predicted that Hillary Clinton had a greater than 79% chance of winning the state. Debbie Dingell wasn't buying it. The congresswoman says now she's determined to work with anyone who wants to help the people whose discontent she's been listening to for years.
I think we have to do a lot of soul searching. You know, I took on the nomination process in 2008 and swore I'd never do it again. And I'm telling you right now, I am going to look at it again. You know, we have a two-party system. But what does that two-party system mean? Quite frankly, years ago, I say to people, I was Republican before I married my husband. For those who are listening, he was a prominent Democrat. His family was a prominent Democrat. You can't very well marry a prominent Democrat and stay in the Republican Party. But I haven't changed anything I believed in. When I was young, I was a Milliken Republican. And as I'm more seasoned, I'm a Dingell Democrat.
William Milliken, by the way, being the governor of Michigan, and John Dingell being the very famous congressman from Michigan.
That's correct. And they both have the same value systems. They both cared about working people. So I think we have to do some very real soul searching about, do we have a nomination process that is nominating the strongest candidate?
But there's something about this establishment. You guys have all failed over the last 30 years. I mean, that's what Trump said over and over again. Hillary, you've been there for 30 years. All this bad stuff has happened. Nothing's worked. The message that the forgotten folks in the union halls get is, yeah, throw them all out and see if this guy can do something. What's your takeaway from that?
So I'm going to say several things. One, I'm going to, you know, I think that Bernie Sanders was very eloquent yesterday in saying that he was prepared to work with him if he was going to do something to help these people that you and I are talking about. And if he pursues racist, sexist, xenophobic, and anti-environment policies, we're all going to vigorously work against him. But, you know, this anti-establishment rhetoric bothers me in that I don't exactly think Donald Trump's not establishment. You know, he's a billionaire and surrounded himself with good, experienced people that I probably don't agree with for most of them, but some of them are friends. Newt Gingrich is a very good and close friend, but I also wouldn't call any of them non-establishment. I want somebody who knows what they're doing any job that's going to impact my life. So I don't approve of his rhetoric. I found his rhetoric divisive during the campaign. He was more statesmanlike when he won on election night. And I'm, you know, which Donald Trump is going to come to the White House is going to be interesting. But I think this country is America. We have an orderly process for that transference of government, and we've got to give him the opportunity to go to work on the problems that he told people he would go to work on.
Is there an elite problem, and that a message needs to be framed by you or someone in the Democratic Party that worked better than whatever Hillary tried to do that reaches these folks without sounding like you're some sort of elite?
I tried desperately not to be part. I mean, you could take my profile and say it, but I live in those. The reason that I knew what was happening, and, you know, for months said to people, I was the only person in Michigan who said that Hillary was in trouble for the primary. I, at every Rotary Club, Economic Club, and then, yes, take it up to the elite media, said Donald Trump's going to win the nomination. And I told repeatedly to people Donald Trump could win this election, and everybody thought that I was certifiable. But the reason I knew it is I go to the bars. I'm in those union halls. That is what I do every weekend. People say I do too much. I don't do too much. I want to know what people are thinking. And if you're listening to people, you know what was in their heart. As I was driving here to do this interview this morning, I thought of my first trip, day two, my being a member of Congress. So I flew to Michigan with President Obama. And I said, you know, Mr. President, you saved this industry. And everybody here is enormously grateful to you for that. But people on the ground are still scared. They don't feel the recovery. They're worried that their job is still in danger any second.
It's not about race. It's not about sexism. It's not about Trump as a, you know, sexual assaulter.
All those things matter. And when you go out and, you know, I talked to people yesterday, my Muslim community in Dearborn, largest Muslim population in the country, they're scared to death, scared to death. And members of the African-American black community are angry. You hear it. You see it. And as a woman, I'm so offended by things that he said. I've experienced sexual harassment my entire career. But I think that everyday issues matter to everybody. They're not black, white, LGBT issues. Everybody. So we need to be really sensitive to that. And I think it's going to be interesting to see if Donald Trump cleans up his act.
She got the message long before many others in the Democratic Party did about Trump's appeal in the industrial North, something that we saw on Tuesday. Congresswoman Debbie Dingell is Democratic representative from Michigan's 12th district. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Those crowds of Trump supporters we saw during the campaign, and especially this week, sport those red Make America Great hats. You've seen them. They're mostly white faces in the crowds, but they actually represent a vast collection of people with different ideas about what Trumpism is and what Trump is going to accomplish over the next 4 years and possibly beyond. Paul Ramsey comes from the alt-right movement. He espouses principles of white identity, something we explored in a conversation about his new connection with Donald Trump. Ramsey is a YouTube vlogger who blogs under the name Ramsey Paul. He says it's time to take steps to restore America to what he calls its natural state, white and Christian. And he thinks a billionaire from Queens is going to do that.
Hey, guys, we did it. We won. This has been, I think, the greatest moment since the fall of communism in 1989. We have seen the fall of the globalists. It's happened.
That's Ramsey celebrating very happily yesterday. He says he's looking far down the road as he thinks about Trumpism, far down the road to a new America.
Well, I'm for diversity, and the best way to preserve diversity is through separate nations. Now, if you're going to go down the road of 100% racial purity, that's ridiculous. No country has that. But a country needs to have at least a high percentage, like 80 or historically in the United States, 90% a white Christian heritage. And that's what our country was, and that's what's changing.
If you want to get the 90% Christian white heritage, you're talking about some significant changes in the demographics of America, which is rapidly becoming a white minority nation. What are you going to do about that? What's Trump going to do about that?
Right. And everyone says that's, you know, a good thing. And I disagree with that.
All right, what do you want Trump to do about that?
Well, the first thing is, you got to start with the basics, right? Is to enforce a border and enforce our current immigration laws. That's
how long will you give Donald Trump, President Donald Trump, to deport those 14 million and get on to the next step of getting us to that 90% Christian heritage?
Well, the first thing you can do is through the companies and have severe penalties if you hire illegals. That can be done right away. So that will help to self-deport a lot of people right off the bat. Then you enforce our current border, and that helps that too. Now,
What about Muslims?
Well, the same thing. I think we need to have a ban on general migration until we get this thing sorted out. I'm not against Muslims. If you're a Muslim and you have your religion in the country, that's fine. But we're under no obligation. It was never considered that in the United States that we must take endless populations on our compatible with us. It's just crazy, and I don't know why we would want to do that. No one else does.
Okay.
Other countries don't do that.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to turn into Germany where, you know, they're being flooded with Muslims. I'm in Hungary now here. They don't allow the flood of the refugees in. And guess what? You were talking about how Budapest is a nice city. Why is it a nice city? Because they don't allow the flood of Muslims in here so the women can walk the streets without the threat of getting raped. That's the good thing.
So women can walk the streets without the threat of getting raped?
Yeah. Have you ever heard of Cologne, Germany? You know, the rape attacks there? Have you heard of that? And I'll take you here to Budapest. You can walk the streets day or night, and there's no issues here. Why? Because this isn't a diverse land here in Budapest. This is primarily 90% Hungarian. And they're
all right. Okay. And, you know, you're describing a situation that is going to be anything but the United States in a decade. In a decade, whites will be the minority. And so all of these scenarios that you're describing, these...
Yeah. You guys were saying that Clinton was going to win, 95% certainty, right? I was told in the early 1980s when I went to college that the Soviet, the communism, that's the wave of the future. You need to get used to it. You're in denial if it's not. The Soviets are really increasing, and that's just the way it's going to be. And it fell. It fell apart in the 80s. So these predictions of the future are notoriously wrong, because what we're seeing now with this Trump presidency is an awakening of white identity. Because we have other identities, and it's really good. Everyone loves black identity. Viva la raza. I don't know what la raza means. Maybe you can get your Spanish-speaking listeners to explain that word. But it's okay for them to have that identity. Or Jews, they have their identity. In fact, they have their own damn homeland that we support. And that's considered a good thing that we keep Israel Jewish. And there's no thing, we need to diversify Israel. No, and there's no talk about that. So there's nothing wrong with our people having our identity. That's what we are.
What would you say to African-Americans, people of color, Muslims, who maybe fear some of the things that you're saying and fear some of the things they've heard Donald Trump say about vetting them, deporting them, calling them terrorists, asserting that they're not fully American?
Yeah, we don't care. I don't care what people fear or think or anything like that. They don't, in other countries, they don't have the same concern. Am I fearful that Israel won't take Christians? No, because that's their country. Am I fearful I can't go to Saudi Arabia and practice my Christianity? No. So that's just the way it is. So, I mean,
but what about your Muslim neighbor down the street in Oklahoma?
What about it? I just said we are not going to deport citizens, or people have a freedom of religion to worship as they choose in the United States. I don't think that should change.
But what would you say to them if they're fearful of some of these ideas that have been espoused during the campaign of of separating Muslims or you know, surveillance of Muslims or
Profiling of Muslims. I'm just tired of a little bit of the bull about, oh, these poor Muslims, are they going to be so scared? What did we say to them about the backlash? I mean, who the hell is blowing up who in this world? Is Muslims blowing us up? You remember France? You remember the slaughter that they did and the Muslims in the Orlando nightclub? So come on. I mean, yeah, maybe one
that was
Christian,
an American citizen. That was an American citizen.
Yeah, and also a Muslim, wasn't it?
And if violence results from some of these ideas in the United States?
Well, violence is already, what are you talking about? Multiculturalism has already resulted in violence. Look at after Obama. Are we post-racial? No, hell no. We have Black Lives Matter rioting, targeting white police officers. We have the situation of France, the Muslims murdering, massacring people, torturing them. What are you talking about? What if violence starts? It has started. It started because of multiculturalism.
So there is a race war going on in the United States today, and that you would join up.
There's a conflict that everyone has that they want self-determination. That's for all people. I want to call it a race war because it's more complicated than race. Nationalism, race is only a component.
But you hear the words Black Lives Matter, and that essentially means war to you.
No, targeting white police officers and murdering them is a type of violence and of war, yes, of course. Right? What would happen if we did a White Lives Matter and started targeting blacks? Hell, that organization be shut down so fast with RICO and people be in jail for 20 years if you tried that. So maybe that will happen under Trump, too. I'd like to see him use RICO against Black Lives Matter and throw the leaders away for 20, 30 years for civil rights violations. It would happen if it was reversed. You know it.
Paul Ramsey, who blogs under the alt-right handle Ramsey Paul, R-A-M-Z-P-A-U-L, spoke with us from Hungary, but blogs from Oklahoma. Paul, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
The surprise of this election has been a challenge for some parents. Of course, for others, it was victory. And so it was high fives from families in places around the country. But we've heard from a lot of you out there who were sincerely, sincerely full of anxiety because of this election. And Asia Badi is a Muslim woman and mother of two daughters who shares that anxiety. She lives here in New York City. And listening to her when we spoke was a lesson this week in civics. The hope of an American dream that Asia says is still alive, even though she's had to deal with some significant fear this week.
The morning of, after the election, yesterday morning, I heard the results, and I really dreaded having to tell them. And I had to really think about, how do I tell them in a way that they feel okay and are comfortable and not scared? So my older daughter, Antalya, woke up and came out, and she asked me what happened, and I told her, and she said, okay. Didn't say much. She's very composed and quiet. But my little one, I went to tell her. Anaya is 8 and very intrigued by the whole process. And I told her, and she's like, Mama, you know, you're kidding, right? There's no way. I said, no, honey. Donald Trump is president. And her little face crumpled up. And I was like, are you sad? And she said, yeah, Mama. And she cried, and she cried, and she crawled into my lap. And so we talked, and we talked about the fact that even if he's president, there's a lot of laws and regulations. We talked about the fact that there's a Senate and a Congress and the Supreme Court and all these people that are there to make sure that nothing bad happens and that people are safe.
Do your children believe that Donald Trump hates Muslims?
So my younger one, earlier this year, she came home from school after hearing a conversation about that, asking me if Donald Trump became president, would we have to leave our home? She's been nervous about it and worried about it. And at that time, I told her that, no, I mean, he says that, but he really can't do that because of the laws in America. And there are a lot of people that are going to make sure that that doesn't happen.
I spoke with someone who said We won in response to the Trump victory. And he represents a whole set of ideologies, among them being, you know, it would be great if in 40, 50 years, America returned to being 90% white and Christian. How does that make you feel?
It's horrible, right? Because it means that the only America that those people see is a very white Christian America. And they don't see that even if I'm not white and I'm not Christian, I have some very similar beliefs and ideals, right? We believe in everyone having the right to have access to education. Like my Christian and Jewish friends, we want our children to have education. We want them to be comfortable and happy and successful in whatever way they are. Those are all ideals that have no race, that have no religious sort of dumb. Everybody believes in those things. And the fact that people can't see past that, it's upsetting. And it's scary. But I don't believe that everybody's like that. I know there's a portion of the population. I really can't believe that everyone's like that. I think that, you know, if people truly knew others and were given opportunities to meet other people, they would see the similarities. I see that in Ohio. I see that in the communities that I know here.
What do you think is the impediment that keeps America from mixing better? There are plenty of people who support Donald Trump who think that multiculturalism doesn't work.
Yeah.
One of the evidences of that is, and I don't believe it, but one of the evidences of that could be that we don't mix well. We don't see people who are different from us enough to make a difference. What do you think could change that?
I don't have an answer, John. I really don't have an answer on that one. I don't know how. I think there'll be time. I think that over time, there are more and more immigrants coming into the country. And I think that is fearful for people. But those people will come and they stay and they become second generation Americans. Just like historically, the Italians and the Irish were considered sort of a scary.
Oh, but they're white. They're white. That's different. They're white. See, they're
I know.
White.
I hear you. I mean, I am scared of that.
Well,
but do I want to instill that in my children? No.
No. Well, we do have a lot of work to do.
We do.
All of us. The Muslim world and the Arab world and places where I've spent a lot of time mm-hmm. as a foreign correspondent are places where institutions are weak, mm-hmm. where people are full of suspicion, mm-hmm. where you get rounded up on the street and thrown in prison. And those stories undoubtedly have made their way into – you know, your household mm-hmm. About, you know, the places where Muslims are the majority.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to your children that is the principal difference between those places and the United States right now?
I think we have stability. We have a government that that exists. We have freedom of speech, right? We have the ability to actually get the word out and that people respond. You know, I joined a community board, and that has been empowering, right? And I've gotten to know people who are elected officials and people who want to be elected officials. And one of the things I keep telling my Muslim community, whether they're here or far, is that there is a path. You have to find that path and get to know your elected officials and get to know the people who want to be elected officials and be an elected official or whatever and really advocate. So, you know.
Have you told your daughter that?
Yeah, I told her that. Now I'm even more inspired for them to be part of that process and feel empowered.
All right. Atsia, thank you so much.
Thank you. Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, please.
So over the summer, we discussed a lot about what was going on. And I mentioned to my daughters one time, one of the RNC leaders told people, didn't endorse Trump, but he did say, you know, pick who you want. Pick who you believe is the best. And my 8-year-old Anaya said, Mama, I was just daydreaming about that. And I said, you're daydreaming about Ted Cruz? She's like, no, I was daydreaming. I was running for president. And I said to the people, pick who you think is right. Pick who you think is going to do a good job.
No, that sounds like hope.
I know, and I want to keep that hope.
All right, thank you so much, Atsia.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and we're still listening. For the first time since 2001, the GOP has control of all three branches of government. Kim Alfano, Republican strategist and CEO of Alfano Communications, also a partner in the bipartisan polling firm Raba Research. Kim, where's the party?
I think that you have to look at Donald Trump as being more independent than Republican, because if you listen to what he said on the trail, he talked about big ideas that transcended both parties. So while we have both, all three arms of government, I think it's going to be dramatically different than just electing a Republican president would normally be with both houses and the Senate.
So you think we still have a kind of divided government right now?
I think we have a transitioning government. I think what Donald Trump represents is the anti-political establishment. He is the sort of slap in the face to the politicians saying you can't be ideological sycophants or not get anything done or spend your days posturing for the media and plotting re-elections. I think he's the guy that comes in there and shakes up the Tea Party as much as he shakes up the very liberal left.
So if this is not the week for sycophants, what did you make of Paul Ryan begging for his job yesterday in that smiley news conference that he gave?
Well, Paul Ryan always looks and sounds good, which is good for our party. But I have to say, I think that I didn't take that away from that. I think that he and Mitch McConnell honestly are frustrated with the way things have gone in the past and their inability to even coalesce their own party together to get things done. I think they're both genuinely anxious to pass some laws and to change some things.
But the Freedom Forum has already said we're talking about leadership in the Congress, which means Ryan's probably going to go or at least have a challenge. It seems to me Ryan yesterday was saying, I got two phone calls from Trump. He wants me to be speaker. I think, you know.
Well, I think he does, honestly. I think that that Donald Trump is not going to let the Tea Party push the Republican Party around. And I think that the challenge to Ryan, where is it going to come from? And I think he is Donald Trump's best bet. I mean, Ryan has been trying for the last, you know, since he's become speaker to try to put the party back together and to try to make it work together. And I think Donald Trump is a big muscle for that.
I got two words for you, though, Kim. You know, Eric Cantor, the last person who wasn't going to let the Tea Party push him around, boom, he's what? He's on CNN occasionally?
Yeah, but dramatically different times, dramatically different person. Eric Cantor was a part of the far right. He was a part of the Tea Party. Paul Ryan comes out of that, but not in the same way. He is not an ideological far right Republican. Paul Ryan is, you know, maybe conservative when it comes to economic issues, but Paul Ryan is much more of a team builder than Eric was. And I work for Eric Cantor. He's a wonderful guy. He's a very nice guy. But that's a dramatically different comparison.
Okay, so three things. Number one, the Supreme Court is going to turn into a Heritage Foundation conservative think tank.
I disagree with that. I think that we will certainly get a couple of conservative justices over the course of the Trump presidency. But I don't think that Donald Trump is the type of president that will look to legislate from the Supreme Court.
Obamacare is gone.
Yes, I think it is, but not until it's replaceable. I think that Trump understands that you can't kick all of the folks that are now entrenched on the rolls off and not have a huge backlash from the very people that put him in office.
In 4 years, there'll be a flat tax.
Sure, I would love that, and I think Donald Trump probably will edge that way. I think there's a lot more that'll get done first.
Kim Alfano is a Republican strategist and a CEO of Alfano Communications and a partner in the bipartisan polling firm of Raba Research. Thanks so much, Kim.
Thanks, John.
You know, a lot of people inside the Beltway are wondering if they will get to be asked to be in the Trump cabinet or in the administration in some form. But everyone in uniform right now at the Pentagon knows they're going to report to the commander-in-chief. What do they think of President-elect Trump and some of his casual comments about nuclear weapons and military strategy? Admiral Mike Mullen served as the 17th chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff for both the George W. Bush and Obama administrations. He has all kinds of experience leading change in complex organizations, and he says this transition will be a challenging one for Donald Trump and for the U.S. Armed Forces.
Like a lot of people, I was in one way surprised at the outcome. On the other hand, I think that President-elect Trump tapped a vein in the country that was not being answered by Washington, D.C., and that we're seeing the results of that. And I think now that the election's over, I think it's important that we all get behind him and figure out how to try to address those and make it work.
Well, the uniformed services have no choice but to get behind him. He is the commander in chief. And Donald Trump has said some things that people in the military have taken public issue with. Where is this headed, do you think?
First of all, the military is a large outfit. It's 2.1 million men and women, and so there's certainly going to be views across that total number of people who currently serve in our military. Certainly having worked for President Bush and for President Obama, you have individuals that come from, you know, different backgrounds and different views. And so while not dwelling on what they did, I think that we're going to see in the future, you know, an adjustment based on, you know, soon to be President Trump, based on his view of the world, based on people that he surrounds him with to address the significant challenges that are out there. And that it would be different from his predecessor, I guess, wouldn't surprise me at all.
But do you think the power of the presidency is getting greater and that Donald Trump signals that he wants an even greater power?
There's always been tension, you know, within the branches of government with respect to the power, so that it occurred to some degree during the Bush administration. Again, it's occurred in the Obama administration. There's going to be a version of that also, which will occur in the Trump administration. And I actually depend on the checks and balances that are there overall. I have great faith in that. You know, overall, it'll still be both checked and balanced.
Although there's been a whole discussion within the military, and you're well aware of this, of a critique of the civilian control of the military in the United States and the way it's traditionally been. What is the state of civilian control of the military when someone like Donald Trump suggests that we target families in Iraq and Afghanistan and active military personnel say, I will disobey that order?
I think the state of civilian control in the military is in really good shape. I think it's a fundamental principle in the democracy in which we live and that we need to continue to adhere to it. The military leadership, when I was there, and certainly the current military leadership, our job is to follow the direction of the President of the United States, duly elected by the American people, and to carry out, in this case, his orders. If, in fact, you know, a military leader is in a position that they disagree with those orders, they have, from my perspective, they have one choice, and that is to quietly walk away. That's the system that we have. It's a proven system over a long period of time, and it's one that has held up in very difficult, very complex times, and I think we are in the middle of very difficult and very complex times. You know, this country has been through a lot over the course of its life. And in the end, we've been able to see our way through it, where in the long run, the country gets stronger. I'm generally an optimistic guy. I think it is a great country. It's got great resources and great people. But that doesn't diminish the challenges that are out there that I think the country and the leadership will have to continue to address, given the challenges that are out there in the world.
Admiral Mike Mullen is the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, John.
Admiral Mullen had lots more to say, and you'll hear it tomorrow on our Veterans Day program. If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.